Good morning. Welcome to AM. It is Friday, the 15th of March. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The Fair Work Commission is expected to decide today if aged care workers will get a bigger pay rise, and if so, how many across the sector will receive it. Aged care advocates hope increased salaries will help to attract much-needed staff. Here's political reporter Evelyn Manfield.
A 25% pay rise for aged care workers. That's what the Health Services Union is hoping the Fair Work Commission will decide today. The union's national president is Jared Hayes.
We've been working on this matter for in excess of 10 years. The interim 15% increase was very welcome a little over 12 months ago, but now we're at the point where we want to get aged care fixed now and for the future, and a reasonable salary with a 25% tag to it will go a long way to doing that.
And the employers of aged care workers are on board.
There's several reasons, but mainly because they deserve it and they're underpaid as it is.
Jane Pickering is the chief executive of Eldercare, an aged care home in South Australia.
It'll be at least a few dollars an hour. I think we need to acknowledge that they provide enormous value to the community, and by paying them more, that's a one way of really acknowledging the value of this sector.
The argument for a pay rise put forward by the union is that work in aged care has been traditionally undervalued. And it's time that ended, especially as the needs of residents become more complex.
Whilst it's an incredibly rewarding area to work, aged care, it's also very demanding. So it's physically demanding, emotionally demanding.
Paul Sadler is an aged care consultant and the former boss of the Aged and Community Care Providers Association. He says today's decision is a big deal.
I think it's absolutely being waited for with a bit of bated breath, because we know how important improving the wages of aged care have been. We've been uncompetitive in the wage market compared to health, compared to disability services or retail.
A wage increase was a key recommendation of the Aged Care Royal Commission, and in late 2022, the Fair Work Commission made an interim decision that direct care workers should get paid at least 15% more, saying the previous rates didn't properly compensate them for the value of their hard work. It's costing $11.3 billion over 4 years, paid for by the federal government, and the sector hopes the government would cover any further rise too. Despite workforce numbers bouncing back a bit since COVID, Paul Sadler says many more people are still needed and better pay could help to attract them.
The aged care workforce remains scarce in some areas, particularly in rural and remote areas.
Not only is it a push to get nursing and caring staff more pay, but the cleaners, cooks and admin staff too.
That report from Evelyn Manfield. Australia's child support system is being reviewed for the first time since the Howard government. Some parents and experts say the system is outdated, failing women and not keeping pace with the increasing cost of living. The federal government is being urged to make changes to reflect rising costs, especially in education. Here's National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy.
Shopping these days is expensive.
Single mum Carolyn Page has made it through another busy day supporting her two young sons. Even with full-time work, it feels like a daily battle as cost of living pressures mount.
So when you consider the cost of groceries at the moment, your utilities, car running costs, general school costs, extracurricular activities, kids' parties, clothing costs.
Carolyn Page works full-time and her income is supplemented by about $100 a week in child support payments. That barely touches the sides, she says, and she believes Australia's child support system, which was last redesigned about 20 years ago, fails to recognise modern parenting costs.
It's completely outdated. We have a situation where our children are required to bring an iPad to school as of year four. That cost just isn't factored in.
The complicated child support system currently being reviewed by the federal government assumes public education is free, while Carolyn Page says it's close to breaking her budget.
There is no such thing as a free education.
It's not the only cause for concern. Annual increases to child support are pegged to male total average weekly earnings, not inflation. Phoebe Walesh from Step Families Australia says cost of living pressures have an extra impact on blended families trying to support two households.
Child support is an archaic system, really. It hasn't kept up to date with the cost of living at all.
New figures show that pressure biting and suggest the system also struggles with compliance. In the 2023 financial year, there was a $50 million shortfall between what was owed in child support payments, $1.93 billion, and what was collected, about $1.88 billion. The cumulative total of unpaid child support payments now stands at $1.7 billion spread across 218,000 parents. Kay Cook from Swinburne University of Technology is an expert on child support payments.
So over time, the amount of child support that will be paid is losing real value.
Professor Cook says it's disproportionately hurting women.
The research shows that over time, after separation, mothers' income will greatly decline if they were working, and their wealth will decline, whereas separated fathers' earnings and wealth will increase over time.
In a statement, the Department of Social Services said it used male total average weekly earnings to reflect the increased cost of living, and it's commissioned an expert panel to examine broader changes to the system.
That's National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy. A coalition of more than 80 homelessness and housing organisations has written to the Federal Housing Minister calling for more homes for young people experiencing homelessness. They say the federal government is failing the tens of thousands of young Australians who are alone with nowhere to live. The Housing Coalition says the issue must be prioritised in the upcoming National Housing and Homelessness Agreement. Oliver Gordon reports.
When 21-year-old Paris DeLove was experiencing homelessness, she wrote music to get through.
I think music is therapy and was definitely used as a coping mechanism for me during such a difficult time.
She spent years couch surfing, facing tough choices every day.
What am I going to have to do to have accommodation? Does this mean I have to degrade myself? Does this mean that I have to be around people that potentially don't have my best interest in mind? You know, is my safety going to be at risk? Yeah, it was. I think if anything, it was just the most stress-enduring experience of my life.
A coalition of more than 80 housing organisations say too many young people are slipping through the cracks. The group say the National Housing and Homelessness Plan, a 10-year strategy being developed at the moment, must include a plan for 15,000 dedicated housing places for 15 to 24-year-olds sleeping rough. Kate Colvin is the Chief Executive of Homelessness Australia, which is part of the coalition. She says the accommodation that's needed is far too rare.
Look, there wouldn't be more than a couple of hundred. There's only a handful that have been resourced in different states and territories. And what we know is that young people need, particularly young people who've been through homelessness, need both support and affordable housing so that they can move on with their lives.
So we've got 16-year-olds competing with adults like myself for the same house.
That's Melbourne City Mission's Shauna Moore. The advocate works with young people in homeless shelters, many of whom are being forced into uncomfortable situations.
They face significant levels of harm, including abuse. They're forced into these intimate relationships, often with much older people, just to keep a roof over their head. Their mental health is deteriorating out of control.
After years of couch surfing and homelessness, Paris DeLove has managed to find a secure place to live, allowing her space to think about the next phase of her music career. She's appealing to the Minister for Housing, Julie Collins, to take this issue seriously.
Give them the opportunity to know stability and safety, because a lot of these young people haven't known that.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Minister said the federal government is spending more than $91 million a year tackling youth homelessness, and is committed to boosting housing supply to ensure there are enough affordable homes.
That's Oliver Gordon. Queensland authorities are trying to track down dozens of people who took home asbestos-contaminated mulch from a council depot in Rockhampton. The deadly material has also been found in new sites in the ACT as the contamination crisis continues to spread. The Minns government in New South Wales has moved to toughen the state's environmental laws in a bid to crack down on those responsible. Federal, state and territory ministers are expected to meet soon to consider a new national strategy to deal with the millions of tons of deadly material. Experts warn that much of the bonded asbestos cement products still in use in many homes and other buildings could start to disintegrate, generating the more dangerous friable or loose asbestos fibres that pose a greater threat to human health. Nick Grimm reports.
There's kids playing here near the playground, people walking with their dogs, so it's really upsetting to think that we might be exposed to asbestos.
Over recent weeks, more and more Australians have watched in alarm as parkland, school playgrounds and other public areas have been taped off, while others have wondered if the fuss is really necessary.
A lot of the places where the asbestos is dumped is not places you'd walk on anyway.
Is it overkill? I don't know.
From a purely risk-based perspective, yes, it is an overreaction.
Certainly experts like occupational hygienist Andrew Orfanos have been at pains to stress the risk to the public has been low.
So it's very hard to be able to actually generate a particle small enough that would be, you know, less than 5 microns in size and get into your lungs.
There's estimated to be around 6.2 million tonnes of asbestos material in Australia's built environment. Up until its use ended in the mid-1980s, it was commonly used in fibro sheeting, roofing, ceiling insulation, fencing and underground piping.
So if you've got a home built before 1990, it's highly likely you would have asbestos in it somewhere.
Julia Collins is from the Asbestos and Silica Safety Eradication Agency.
So asbestos becomes dangerous when it's damaged, disturbed or deteriorating. So when the material is bonded, it's less dangerous. But the problem is that the materials in our buildings now are becoming old. So anywhere between 30 to 100 years old, and that means that even these bonded materials are starting to degrade, often becoming brittle, especially where they have been exposed to weather or disturbance, and that does increase the risk of releasing asbestos fibres into the air. So we really believe that there's now becoming, I think, a more urgent need to start looking at, you know, how can we increase the rate of removal of these materials in our environment.
But there's uncertainty over how that process is moving forward. For the past decade, the process has been driven by phases 1 and 2 of the Asbestos National Strategic Plan. The second phase ended in 2023. But after years of consultations with stakeholders, phase 3 is yet to be unveiled, and that's causing concern.
We're going to see these flare-ups and these crises constantly over the years if we don't have a systematic approach to it.
Matt Peacock is a former ABC journalist and author of Killer Company, which detailed how manufacturer James Hardie concealed the asbestos threat posed by its products.
If we keep dealing with the problem as a piecemeal thing, then it's going to cost us a whole lot more than if we start providing incentives for people to drop their asbestos off at legitimate disposal sites and actually have a systematic approach to removing it from the buildings where it is.
And that, he hopes, can be the focus of the new Asbestos National Strategic Plan, with federal, state and territory ministers expected to meet soon to consider the new blueprint.
That's Nick Grimm reporting now. Thailand's a national animal has become a national problem as wandering elephants visit villages, destroy crops and even kill people. Once on the brink of extinction, elephant numbers have now rebounded and they're increasingly venturing out of national parks with significant consequences. Southeast Asia correspondent Lauren Day reports from Prachinburi province in central Thailand.
A battered old ute kicks up dust as it winds through forest tracks in search of a herd of elephants. The tray is loaded with volunteers like local cane farmer Suntorn Komkai, who say they've been left to deal with the growing problem of wandering giants, destroying crops and even breaking into homes.
Wild elephants are not a natural disaster. Wild elephants are a mistake of the state because the government could not manage the problem.
Suntorn started these volunteer patrols after an elderly relative was killed on his farm. The woman called Tang was picking vegetables with her sister-in-law Prasong Promchat when she was trampled to death.
I was scared he would hurt me too, but he did not. I kept saying, "Father, please spare me. Please don't hurt me."
Prasong is still traumatised by the incident and now lives in fear of the animals.
I wish our village can live in peace and comfort. I don't want elephants to come around. There are so many of them coming.
Tang was one of 135 people killed by elephants in Thailand in the past 5 years. Once on the brink of extinction, elephant numbers have bounced back at the same time as their habitat has shrunk, forcing them to look for food elsewhere. Back on patrol, the volunteers launch an infrared drone to try to spot the animals in the dense forest. And sure enough, there are a couple just a few hundred metres away. The team waits in the dark until they cross the road, then fires flares to hurry the elephants back to the national park. It's a dangerous job, which Suntorn Komkai says shouldn't be up to villagers.
I am not angry with the wild elephant, but I am angry with the weak government. Everything is blocked by the bureaucratic system.
Padet Laitong from the Department of National Parks agrees they're under-resourced to deal with the escalating issue.
In terms of budget, we must admit that we have a very small budget to support us. I understand that the government has so many missions and responsibilities to take care of the people, but we would like to get more funding to solve the problem.
The Thai government did not answer the ABC's questions. This is Lauren Day in central Thailand reporting for AM.
Would you eat a non-venomous snake? It's a food devoured by millions around the world, and a new report out today says snake meat could offer an alternative to traditional meats. That's because of how quickly the animals grow and how little food they need. Researchers say farming pythons would also have less impact on the environment than conventional meat production. Alison Shaw reports.
To many, snakes are a source of fear. But for some scientists, the creatures offer a fascinating opportunity.
We saw these extraordinary growth rates that the pythons could achieve, and we said, holy crap, we need to study this.
Conservation scientist Dr. Daniel Nartouche is the chair of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. He's one of the co-authors of a new report that finds farmed pythons could become an abundant food source.
They get their energy from the sun. It's a bit like solar power. Chickens. Imagine having a chicken, but it's powered by the sun instead of by the food it eats. They can go for very long periods without needing any food at all. You know, you're taking a 90 gram hatchling snake and then within a year turning it into a 15 kilogram animal that's almost 3 to 4 meters long. And so very rapid protein production.
Snake meat has long been common in parts of Asia and Africa, and Daniel Nartouche points out pythons in particular have high nutritional value. People would just need to get their heads around the fact they're eating a snake.
They're very high in protein, just as high as salmon and chicken, those sorts of things. They're incredibly low in saturated fats, very high in omega-3s. It's a superfood, really.
We are living in a world that we are overexhausting our resources. We actually need 70% more food to be grown.
Dr. Diana Bogueva is a sustainability expert at Curtin University. She studies better ways to feed the world, but admits python meat will have a big marketing challenge on its hands.
As the demand for animal-based food products increases faster than the rising global population, a novel strategy for carbon-neutral food production are more important for us than ever before. There are other barriers in consumer minds related to snakes. So I'm a little bit skeptical about python, but you never know.
Do you think you would ever try eating a snake?
No, never.
And certainly on the streets of Sydney, snake meat doesn't seem quite to everyone's taste.
My biggest fear is snakes, so no.
Probably not, really. I'm a vegetarian, so.
I don't think I could get past the fact it's a snake, yeah.
Yes, why not? Try everything once.
But as someone who has tried it, Daniel Nartouche gives snake meat a big thumbs up.
Basically, you run your knife along the back of the snake above the ribs and you get a 4 meter long, thick bit of python steak that you can just chop up into however many portions you want. At risk of sounding cliche, yeah, it is a lot like chicken. I've had it barbecued, sauteed and curries, and it's wonderful.
Snakes on a plate. That's conservation scientist Dr. Daniel Nartouche ending that report from Alison Shaw. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sarah.